gentlemen, welcome to the show. I've got to say right now, my co-host and I are, you know, we're dressed pretty well. We're dressed comfortably, and we're sitting in a studio that has some great air conditioning. My name is Ben.
Ben, my name is Noel, which you know, and what's that stank?
What's that stank?
What is that stank?
Did we put some stank on it?
I don't know. I mean, you mentioned the air conditioning, but it's feeling a little stagnant in here today. And I'm wondering, was it you? Who was it?
No, it wasn't me, but we do share this studio with other people.
Perhaps it is I who hath dealt it, for I hath smelt it.
This is something that has very little to do with today's episode, but it's an interesting question.
It's got as much to do with today's episode as anything.
You know, no. What I'm about to bring up. Have you noticed, perhaps you, Noel, or you, our super producer, Casey Pegram, ladies and gentlemen, have you guys ever noticed when you walk into a room, you'll sense a smell, and it may be very good, it may be very bad, but then within a matter of a few seconds or minutes, it sort of dissipates and you don't notice it? Does that happen to you?
You know, it's true. If I've, like, for example, let's say I haven't done laundry in a couple days and I have the laundry basket in my room, it sort of, you know, becomes the base level of the smell of the room. But if I've stayed overnight somewhere else, hubba hubba, and then I come back the next day, I'm like, ho! Laundry day, son.
What unfresh hell is this,
indeed,
right? So we know that this is a phenomenon that a lot of us have experienced, but the fact remains that some smells are so strong that you don't forget them.
No.
Or you can't teach your nose to ignore them. And today's episode is about a stink that was far beyond what you would normally consider smelly.
What either I or Ben hath dealt.
Right.
Previously. That's up for debate.
And likely far beyond what we have smelt.
Indeed.
What we're talking about here is something called the Great Stink of London.
So someone got upset about something? Is that what you're saying?
And
they made a fuss?
Oh, if only. There were fusses involved, right?
Yeah.
There were fusses involved, and the city was in crisis. But also, literally, it was a stink, a stench, a reek.
A miasma.
Oh, here we go.
Of feces,
mm-hmm.
cooking smells. Think of city smells. You know,
right.
New York City, for example. Think of the way it smells walking down the street. The way you can pass through so many different aromas as you travel, right? Like one corner might smell like boiled peanuts, and then you get hot dogs, and then you get dog crap, and then, you know, urine and stale beer.
Mm-hmm.
Well, think about that, but combined with stagnant, rotting feces buried in open pits.
And also livestock corpses, right, from the butchery.
Mm-hmm.
Possibly dead bodies due to disease outbreaks.
Mm-hmm. Like cholera.
Right, like we covered in our previous episode on London's Train for the Dead. They were literally piling bodies upon one another because there was not room. In the, you know, in the conventional cemeteries or morgues. So what we're saying, with all due respect to the great city of London, is that it used to be filthy.
Yeah. I mean, those delightful little street urchins in Oliver, you know, there's no way they could have done those sweet dance moves, you know, with that funk in the air. They would have fallen over dead from just pure hyperventilating exhaustion. And we're talking about the 1800s, but this all kind of came to a head, didn't it, Ben, in a particular summer of stank.
Yes, yes, you're absolutely right, Noel. In the infamous and stench-ridden summer of 1858, London was, I don't want to say paralyzed, but maybe traumatized is a fair word, by a pervasive smell that was flooding the streets and wasn't moving from the town. The temperature was around 90 degrees Fahrenheit or 32 degrees Celsius. And what people noticed was that this smell was not class-based. It didn't matter if you were wealthy or if you were poor or if you lived in a particular neighborhood. Anything near, especially anything near the Thames, was going to stink. And there wasn't much you could do about it. And part of the problem goes into the skyrocketing urban growth at the time.
Absolutely. And the lack of a municipal sewer system.
Yeah.
I mean, as we're saying, they did have sort of storm drain type situations that would essentially drain rain runoff back out into the river. Mm-hmm. But with that overflow of human bodies, live ones that poop, that was all becoming waste, human waste.
Right.
Instead of rainwater, it was wastewater because – you know, some people, the wealthier people, had, you know, privies or there were even flush toilets. We'll get into that a little later. And poor people especially, it wasn't even a poor people, rich people divide. They didn't have a sewer system, so that waste had to go somewhere.
Mm-hmm.
And that somewhere were these cesspits, of which there were in the neighborhood of 200,000 in London alone. London is a sprawling metropolis.
Yes, yeah, a sprawling and at this point dirty metropolis. In an article called Solving the Great Stink, which we will not read the full headline yet because it contains spoilers, right? Mm-hmm. So for now, it's just the article named Solving the Great Stink by Ella Morton. And in this, Morton introduces readers to one of the coolest names you and I found in the course of our research. Right. Because these cesspits are filling up with fecal matter. Right. And there's only so much room in your average cesspit.
6 feet.
6 feet. In case that comes up on your next blind date.
Yeah. 6 feet of poo potential there.
Mm-hmm. That might be important to your Tinder conversation. Yeah. So there's a definitive amount. There's a threshold. And at some point, these pits need to be emptied out. It's literally a dirty job, and someone has to do it. And that's where we learn about the Nightmen.
Oh!
Yes. Yes. We are Always Sunny in Philadelphia fans here. Casey, are you a fan of that show? Yeah?
Oh, we got a definitive nod.
Yeah, that was emphatic. That was not one of his phoned-in nods. Mm. But these Nightmen were real people who had a very demanding job. They had to go into these cesspits, working under the cover of darkness, and empty these things physically. So this is hard physical labor, and the stench isn't just inconvenient at this point. It's dangerous.
Yeah, and these Nightmen, armed with nothing but buckets, rope, and a go-getter attitude, I guess, would, you know, enter these pits. And, yeah, that smell was actually physically damaging. It could give you cough. It could actually cause, you know, burning of your eyes, you know, watering of the eyes, like all kinds of, you could get infections, you know. I mean, it was really, really bad. It was just much, and especially when they're kind of down in it like that, you know. Ugh. This was not a job for the faint of heart.
Yeah.
These were kind of heroes in a way.
They were heroes, and they were also working against nigh impossible odds. No matter how assiduously or regularly they emptied these cesspits, what was happening is that there were just too many people adding to the waste, and they could barely contain it. And let's say they weren't able to empty all the cesspits completely, right? It's very likely at this time. And what happens is that these cesspits start baking under the high summer temperatures.
Yeah, that's right. The sun would get up to around 118 degrees during the summer, which is like West Coast desert temperatures, you know? And you think about that baking, putrefying cesspit. Not to mention that it would leach into the soil.
Mm-hmm.
Into the groundwater or whatever, and then make its way into the Thames, which was London's primary supply of drinking water.
Yes. I am so glad you mentioned that, because we found something that surprised us. Or I don't want to speak for both of us, but I was surprised that surprised us when it came to the history of medicine at the time.
Mm.
Because – you know, we mentioned briefly in our episode on London's Train for the Dead that there were outbreaks of cholera in London. But we'd like to give you a little more detail there to set the stage, because this wasn't just an occasional – one person is sick in one neighborhood thing, right?
No, no. Around 40,000 people died of cholera in London alone between 1831 and 1866. And the thing was, nobody knew. Not only did they not know what caused it, mm-hmm. they had absolutely no idea how to treat it. And the prevailing theory at the time was this thing called miasma theory that even, you know, medical luminaries like Florence Nightingale were all about.
Yeah.
And this was the notion that you got cholera from the funk alone, the mm-hmm. smell.
Like if you can smell it, that means that you are in an invisible cloud of disease known as miasma.
If you smelt it, yeah. you felt it.
Right. There you go. Mm-hmm. There you go.
But that was not true.
That was clearly, now that we have the benefit of looking back in time, it was clearly not the case. But it was widely believed by luminaries of the age. There was a fellow named Edwin Chadwick who wrote a report on the sanitary condition of the laboring population of Great Britain in 1842, and he argued exactly this. He argued that noxious smells were responsible for disease, and the real problem, he said, with cholera and these other outbreaks was a matter of ventilation. And he said in a parliamentary committee meeting in 1846, all smell is, if it be intense, immediate acute disease, and eventually we may say that by depressing the system and rendering it susceptible to the action of other causes, all smell is disease. Which is a pretty bold and definitive statement, especially considering that it's, you know, not true.
No, it's not true. And they, like I said, they didn't know how to treat it either. So treatments ranged from opiates to things like bloodletting, bleeding people, burning their skin. Mm. I'm getting some of these facts from a really cool article called 10 Amazing Facts about cholera and the Great Stink of London from 5-Minute History. And then there are some more gentle cures, some more homeopathic things like using camphor or a syrup of tomato. Some of these came from a book called T.J. Ritter's Mother's Remedies. And those were more like folkloric kind of homeopathic remedies. But yeah, none of this stuff worked. The opiates probably made you feel better, I guess.
Sure.
It's because you were super high.
But I guess gin might do the same thing for people.
This is very true. And the thing I want to mention here to jump off what you said about that if you contain the smell, you can contain the spread of the contamination.
Mm-hmm.
That is couldn't be farther from the truth, especially in the way that they were trying to contain the smell by dumping all of this waste into their water supply.
Right.
They were trying to get it out of their vicinity, but it was coming back to them in the way that was actually infecting them because cholera, it's waterborne in
yes.
this case.
Yeah, and also just pollution in general. One very important thing about putting waste into the Thames is that it is tidal, which means, for instance, if you took the corpse of a horse that you had for some reason and you threw it in the Thames, right, as the tide's going out, then tide comes back in mm-hmm. and the water remains contaminated. But because they were so focused on the idea that smell was the cause and the indicator of this, you know, this epidemic and this outbreak, they did not focus on a point that Noel just raised there, which is the drinking water. We've mentioned this a couple times mm-hmm. already, and we are not alone. There's a character, a real person, sorry, an anesthesiologist of the time named Jon Snow, spelled the same way as the Game of Thrones guy.
Did he know nothing?
It turns out he knew at least one thing.
Okay. What was that one thing?
It was one thing is that he is, according to Death and Miasma in Victorian London, an obstinate belief, if you can see the idea there, by a lecturer named Stephen Holliday, Snow had a very important contribution. He argued that polluted water rather than air was the principal cause of cholera epidemics, and no other experts believed him for some time. He got their version of the cool story bro treatment. So Snow wasn't just, you know, holding a glass of water to the light and looking at it and saying, hey, I think that's a turd in there or something. What he was doing was mapping out pollution-free water sites, polluted water sites, and the spread of disease, specifically cholera. In 1857, he showed that the number of deaths from cholera among customers at the Southwark Water Company was 6 times higher than among customers of the Lambeth Water Company. And he attributed this difference to the fact that the Lambeth Company drew its water from Thames Ditton above the Teddington Lock, where there was no danger from sewage in the tideway. So because they were drinking, you know, non-sewage-riddled water,
yeah,
they were less likely to get cholera.
Genius. No, I mean, I'm kidding, but at the time, it was a mystery.
And it was still ignored, but all was not lost because there was progress in terms of sanitation, right? Like earlier you had mentioned that not everybody was just, squatting by the roadside.
Yeah, no, there were definitely different calibers of restroom facilities. In fact, it wasn't until doing the research for this episode that I discovered, many of you may already know this, that flush toilets were a thing in this period in Victorian England. They were quite ornate, in fact. I found some images of flush toilets in that article I mentioned from 5 Minute History, and they look more like fine china than something you would squat on to relieve yourself. And they had those nice pull handles on the chain, you know, that are up top. Mm-hmm. All that technology was around because it was actually invented by a guy named Sir John Harrington. He came up with the original design for the flush toilet. And I'm looking at it right here on historicuk.com, an article called The Throne of Sir John Harrington by Ellen Castillo. And the illustration of his design is very, very much similar to what we still have today. Mm-hmm. It's got that pee trap at the bottom so that water doesn't stagnate or, you know,
the smell doesn't go
up. Yeah. That's what it is. That it creates a layer of water in that crook because that's what guards against the smell. And it has sort of a bobber kind of situation, very similar, a little more crude. But the middle class loved these things. Mm-hmm. They still do.
Yeah, I'm pretty pro-sanitation myself.
Yeah, now the new thing is the Japanese toilets. They haven't improved on the flush part. Now it's just the stuff that it does to your butt.
It's like a whole experience, though. It's not just a bidet function. It'll play music for you. Yeah. You know,
you can choose the direction of rotation of the water.
No way, really.
The temperature. Oh, yeah.
I know about the temperature.
Yeah. No, I've had the privilege of sitting upon a quite delightful one. And yeah, you can go clockwise, counterclockwise. It's more like a massage chair than it is, a lavatory, but I digress. So the flush toilet was huge among the middle class who could afford it.
Sure.
And you know, the middle class, they, you know, weren't mega wealthy.
But they were like merchants.
They were merchants.
Owned property.
They could afford the finer things, you know, ish, because, you know, the gap between rich and poor was quite wide. The fact there was a middle class at all, you know, they were head and tails above the very poor people. So even that gap was massive.
Sure.
But the gap between the middle class and the aristocracy, also massive. Mm-hmm. But these toilets were flushing practically into the streets. Or like into these pits, right?
Yeah, because there was no sewer system.
Yeah.
It's kind of like having a phone that doesn't connect to a network, except instead of the sounds of your voice through a phone line, you know, it's excrement.
See, in 1846, Parliament passed this law called the Nuisances Removal and Diseases Prevention Act, which also went by the Cholera Bill. And it encouraged people to keep their homes as spotlessly clean as possible to help get rid of the smell. Mm-hmm. So the idea of this flush toilet was that it would carry the waste away from your home. Mm-hmm. You know, but like we know, it went somewhere. And it actually made things way worse.
Right, because there was still not a decent transit system. There was not a purification system of any sort. And as we mentioned before, since the Thames is tidal, what goes around comes back, you know, not Pet Cemetery style, but still in a very disturbing way. I feel like I'm always just trying to work Pet Cemetery into references.
You know, that movie ruined me, right, Ben?
I know. I'm sorry, man. I promise I at least won't do the accent. But perhaps I'm being unfair because they did have something like a transit system for this, sort of a proto sewer, but it just went to the river, right?
Mm-hmm. Yeah, like I said, it was kind of more designed to deal with the overflow from rain, you know, stormwater.
Right.
And that was, and then it would just bring it back out to the river. But it was not designed to deal with 6 feet of stank. Human stank. Yeah, exactly. And the thing is, because of that cholera bill and the notion that if we carry the stink away, we're less likely to get this fatal disease. Mm-hmm. People flush their toilets way more than they should. And they flushed out that proto sewer way mm-hmm. more than they should, which led to much more sewage going out into the river and then back into the drinking
yeah,
water.
So gross. So this also comes to a head. We've got cholera. We've got other diseases. We've got increasingly panicked public sectors. And this comes to a head in Parliament, where in 1858, in this time, they are so affected by the smell that they cannot stay in the building. And they're taking these desperate MacGyver-like measures.
Yeah.
To try to keep the smell out.
Like what?
They use a lime chloride or a chloride of lime and apply it to the curtains by the windows.
Mm. Like soak the curtains mm-hmm. in the stuff?
Yeah. No dice.
No, it didn't work, did it?
Didn't work.
No.
Didn't work.
Well, poop rose by any other name still smells like poop, Ben.
Yes. Yeah. And they said, we cannot – We have no idea what we can do here. They could barely gather their wits enough to hold a meeting. And there are anecdotes you could see where one of the people who's in charge of cleanliness in the building says that he can no longer be responsible for what's happening.
Yeah, I mean, how can you be expected to pontificate when, you know, your nostrils are filled with this overwhelming foul smell. I want to add one little thing to – you mentioned Jon Snow figuring out that the cholera was waterborne. There was another dude that had an interesting role to play, a little scientist by the name of Michael Faraday, who mm-hmm. you may know from the TV show Lost.
Right, or the Faraday cage. Well,
that more. No spoilers, though, for Lost on Ridiculous History. I wouldn't do that to you.
We burned that bridge on our other show.
It's true. But Faraday, there's a great quote from him from that 5-Minute History article where he did some tests. He took some samples, and he described the situation as such. Near the bridges, the feculence rolled up in clouds so dense they were visible at the surface. The whole river was for the time a real sewer. Michael Faraday.
Feculence. God, that's a beautiful word.
It really is.
For a horrific thing. So Parliament realized that they could not ignore this. They couldn't keep the stereotypical stiff upper lip of the aristocracy. They had to fix this problem.
It was affecting them directly. I mean, you could argue this is the kind of thing that's easy for politicians to get behind. Because this is nothing controversial about wanting to get rid of this problem. This is affecting everyone. People are dying by the thousands. And the prince had to cancel his pleasure cruise.
Oh, no.
On the Thames. What's a young monarch to do?
Oh, boy. Tut, so tut.
Things got serious, Ben.
Yes. Yes. You're absolutely correct, my friend, because there had been plans in place for a comprehensive sewage system or sewerage system.
Sewerage.
Sewerage.
Stuff.
We have to say it that way, right?
Yeah, of course.
Sewerage.
We absolutely have to say it that way.
Yes, yes, with that accent. This plan had been proposed by a fellow named Joseph Bazalgette, and he had been pitching this for a little while, but finally, due to the great stink, Parliament approved a bill to combat this, and it took them less than 18 days, which is actually pretty fast for them.
Imagine that, though. I mean, if you're going to get something done quick, let's stop the feces from flowing through our streets freely.
Yeah, you know? We have to emphasize it stank the entire time. And, you know, it's like one long fart joke.
Yeah. Oh, yeah. That's kind of what this episode is, Ben. This guy, Bazalgette, was a civil engineer, right?
Right. He was a civil engineer who played a vital role in, honestly, saving the city. That's not hyperbole for us to describe it this way. In an article called Construction of London's Victorian Sewers, The Vital Role of Joseph Bazalgette, an author named G.C. Cook gives us a brief introduction. So Joseph Bazalgette was born in 1819. At the time, he was the chief municipal engineer to the Metropolitan Board of Works, or MBW. And when Parliament was passing the blame or trying to pass the buck to see who they could scapegoat for this or who they could blame for it, members of Parliament directly said, you know, this is the job of the Metropolitan Board of Works, not us.
Right.
It's these guys. And so he finally got some attention to his elaborate planned sewerage system. It had three objectives: one, waste disposal; two, land drainage; and three, introduction of a safe water supply system. And that made it a, you know, that was a big difference in comparison to earlier plans or existing infrastructure.
And this man was a wizard because he actually added a fourth thing, which was beautification. Mm-hmm. Who'd have thought that putting in a sewer would actually make London, like, look prettier? There were a lot of things that came from this job that added a lot of wow factor to the city, like the embankments on the sides of the Thames.
So let's set the scene. Before Bazalgette's projects, the embankments were disgusting. There's mud and poop everywhere, filthy, dead bodies.
Caked with offal.
Mm-hmm. O-F-F-A-L.
Exactly.
So what happened?
Well, what happened, Ben, is that Bazalgette employed 400 draftsmen to draw up the plans for his sewer system. This is a huge, huge project. And in that 5-minute history article, which I really recommend you checking out, it's fantastic. We've pulled some things from it, but a lot of stuff we have not mentioned. Bazalgette was quoted as saying, well, we're only going to do this once, and there's always the unforeseen. So he doubled his measurements for the sizes the pipes should be, mm-hmm. Based on the calculations he had done. And wow, what do you know? In the 60s, if he had done it based on his original calculations, the sewer would have overflowed.
Oh, wow.
Yeah.
Smart guy.
Very smart guy. Very exacting. But let's just set the scene for what the scope of this project was. 400
sure.
draftsmen to just lay out the plans.
Mm-hmm.
It was 82 miles long.
Mm-hmm.
Of the main part, the main sewer system. 1,100 miles of street, I guess, runoff areas.
Mm-hmm.
And then there were these massive, ornate pumping stations.
And these are beautiful. These look like religious structures.
And then they had water treatment centers as well. But yeah, dude, the pumping stations are a thing to behold. And there are two that you can still see today. One at Crossness, and they had steam pumps that were named after – they had really fancy names. My note here says fancy pants pump names, which were Victoria, Prince Consort, Albert Edward, and Alexandria, which were all members of the British royal family at the time. And then there's another one called Abbey Mills,
mm-hmm.
and both of them have these ornate Byzantine architecture designs. They look like – some sort of temple or something.
Mm-hmm.
It's insane. And apparently one of them you can rent out today, the Crossness Station, which is on the South Bank in Bexley.
Oh, yeah. And it's for what? It's for product launches. That's one of the uses, right?
Yeah, there's an official website for this, and they recommend that you give it a shot for product launches, Shakespearean theater productions, or making viral videos.
That's the one that surprised me as well. Who sets out and says, all right, we're going to make this a viral video. It's time to book the location.
It'd be cool for a music video.
Oh,
I mean,
yeah, it'd be great.
You know, like I said, it's gorgeous.
It'd be a great setting for an action film or a thriller.
Yeah, because, you know, you don't even see what the original intent was. They're just mm-hmm. these insanely huge structures because the pumps themselves were underneath the floor
right.
of the building itself. So when you go in, it's like just this gorgeous space.
And very high ceilings.
Very high ceilings, a lot of intricate marble, I want to say, and like tile work and stuff.
Mm-hmm.
And you don't really see the guts of what it's actually doing.
Mm-hmm. And we would love to hear from you if you have visited here. Mm-hmm. Now, the problem wasn't solved automatically because I think you can tell, friends and neighbors, from the scope of this operation, it took several years for this to be completed, right?
Oh, yeah.
And so, you know, Rome was not built in a day. Neither was Bazalgette's dream system. But as they were building this system, they noticed that there were advantages to populations and neighborhoods that were hooked up to it, and they started to pay more attention to John Snow's previously dismissed belief about contamination in water. And when we say years, we mean, what was it, nearly a decade?
It was over a decade.
Over a decade.
Over a decade. They opened it officially, unofficially, I don't know, in 1865. Edward, Prince of Wales, had a ribbon-cutting ceremony. Mm-hmm. But it wasn't going to be finished for 10 more years from that point.
Right, exactly. And as this construction was occurring, there were people in parts of London that were not part of the system that were still drinking contaminated water, encountering disease, encountering cholera. Mm-mm-mm. And in 1866, London had another cholera epidemic. But people noticed this epidemic occurred in an area that was not yet protected by Bazalgette's sewage system.
It was in the East End, right?
Mm-hmm. Spot on. And this caught the attention of someone named William Farr, who noted that the 1866 epidemic was confined to a small area of Whitechapel, and said that his inquiry showed the East London Water Company's reservoirs had been contaminated. And he wrote, "Only a very robust scientific witness would have dared to drink a glass of water of the river. The element influencing mortality, which has undergone the greatest change in recent times, is the system of drainage." So finally, Bazalgette begins to get his due, as does your man John Snow.
Oh, Bazalgette definitely got his due. He was knighted for his efforts in 1875. And there's a great quote from John Doxat, who is an author and historian. It says, "Bazalgette probably did more good and saved more lives than any single Victorian official." And based on what we're seeing here, that seems to be very likely entirely true.
And there's one other fascinating note that we would like to end today's show on, which is that although the experts were arguing in favor for years about this concept of miasma, it sounds like the common public, and especially the satirist and cartoonist of the time, were on board with the idea of water contamination way earlier than those stiff collars up in Parliament. We see, especially in Punch cartoons of the time, that there's a clear association with health and contamination of water.
That's right. There was a really popular satirical magazine called Punch, or the London Charivari, that came out starting in 1841 and was hugely influential for its political cartoons. And it does an incredible job of chronicling this whole situation over the years with fictional deity by the name of Old Father Thames.
Yes, the spirit of the river.
The spirit of the river. And Priestink, he is portrayed as this very stately, typically nude, bearded, Zeus-like figure. As it turns out, there's a lot of archaeological evidence that there were river worshippers the area. There were a lot of Bronze Age artifacts recovered from the river. Pre-Christian times that were seen as being offerings to some sort of river deity. In 1857, there was this kind of shield that was pulled up, and there was horned helmets that were found. A lot of these things are on display in the British Museum. But this idea of Father Thames, he was sort of this bearded, usually nude, Zeus-like figure surrounded by sea creatures, almost like a King Triton from The Little Mermaid or something like that. But, with no pants.
And this began to change as the river became increasingly contaminated.
Boy, did it ever. Father Thames started being portrayed much more as some sort of terrifying David Lynchian hobo. There's one that keeps popping up, this comic called Father Thames Introducing His Offspring to the Fair City of London. And it has this horrifying creature with matted black tar-covered beard and hair emerging from the river with this kind of shriveled, emaciated mermaid creature and a very skinny, malnourished child and like a zombie kind of thing coming crawling out of the water. So this is not really funny satire. It's much more disturbing than that. And that continued. But here's a happy ending for Father Thames. When all came around, when the sewer system was fully in place, there's a comic from 1884 that shows Father Thames as a dapper, upscale gentleman with a top hat and a coat, holding a trident and doffing his cap to a gentleman with swans bathing in the background. And the caption is, Father Thames is himself again.
Which is a beautiful note to end the story of London's great stink and the innovations that arose from this crisis. We do also want to mention, of course, that the problem of river pollution across the planet has not by any means been solved. Unfortunately, you can see various instances of incredibly vital river sources being incredibly, and some might even add irredeemably, polluted, such as the Ganga or Ganges in India, the Mississippi River here in the United States, and on and on. The good news is, however, that nowadays, thanks in large part to the efforts of people like Jon Snow, people like Basil Gett, and more, we as a species are aware of the supreme importance of sanitation. And hopefully, if you are lucky enough to live near a river, lessons learned from this strange episode of history have been applied to keep your river safe and clean. That's going to wrap it up for us today, folks. As always, we would like to thank our super producer, Casey Pegram, and we'd like to thank Alex Williams for composing our soundtrack.
And we'd also like to thank regular contributor Candace Gibson, who wrote The Great Stink of London for How Stuff Works. But most importantly, we'd like to thank you.
And you can contact us directly via Instagram, via Friendster. Noel, I started a Friendster. Side note, I probably should run that past Casey, but he seems okay with it.
The social media team is going to have a fit.
Yes. Yes, they will have a fit. But check out our Friendster now.
They're still dogging us to make that Pinterest, and I told them no dice!
You can also find us, of course, on Twitter and Facebook, if I didn't mention that earlier. But what do you do if you say, I have a great idea for an episode, I'd like to tell you about my experience living near a river, but I don't want to go for all that hoopla and brouhaha of the social media communication route? We have another way for you to reach us directly.
Yeah, it's called an email, and it's ridiculous@howstuffworks.com. And we hope that you come back and hang with us next time for another episode of Ridiculous History.